Hey, this is Liv Warfield, and you're listening to the Pantheon Podcast.
Pantheon Podcasts presents Deeper Digs in Rock, part of the Rock and Roll Archaeology Project. Music, culture, technology, and rock and roll. Now, on with the show.
You're always dancing down the street with your suede blue eyes, and every new boy that you meet, he doesn't know the real surprise diggers. Christian Swain, the rock and roll archaeologist. Oh, doing silly things at the beginning. You know, I've been doing this for a while. I hope it's okay. I hope you guys get a little chuckle out of it. You know I'm not serious, right? Well, not for that. I'm serious about the rest, though. So, hey, if you haven't heard, I'll remind you one more time. Episode 18, 1969, part one, is now out and available. A year so big in rock and roll that it will take us two full episodes to do it justice. While episode 18... 1969 part one is out. Episode 19, 1969 part two, is seriously being worked on. We are really going to try our best to get this one out sooner than the usual 3 to 6 months that it takes. And it's been more closer to 6 months than 3 months these days. So we are internally trying to mix some things up move the process along here. So please keep our feet to the fire. Plug us along. Send us nasty notes, friendly nasty notes, that is, saying, hey, get to it. What are you going to do? When are we going to get this? You know, that sort of thing. So, I, as I told you guys last week, we do have it all mapped out because, of course, it was originally supposed to be one episode, and it got so unwieldy large that we just had to split it in two, and chronologically we kind of did it, and it just kind of worked out this way too. The first half of the year was primarily in the UK. The second half of the year will be primarily in America. So we are deep in the writing phase, which is always the longest and hardest to accomplish. In the end, what you will get is at least 3 hours of the events in rock and roll and the world at large from 1969. And that gets us pretty much to the end of the 1960s. There'll be one more episode after that. I'm giving you guys a little secret here that will kind of close it out, make a bridge to the upcoming decade of the 1970s, which we're really excited to get into. I bet you guys are all as well. So keep an eye. Hold on to your hats while listening to episode 18, knowing it's only half the tale. The second half of the year is coming. All right. One last thing, and then we'll get right into it. Let's please tell a friend. Take a look at the Pantheon Podcast Network, where you can find the Rock and Roll Archaeology Podcast, this show, Deeper Digs in Rock, and a bunch of other great music related shows, only music shows on Pantheon Podcasts. So you'll appreciate that. Lots of goodness to be had if you just do a little sniffing around and try one or two out. Give it a little bit of a go and see how you like it, and then share. Let us know that you're fans of this one or that one. We're going to be adding some new podcasts too coming up in the next few weeks, so there'll be some new things that'll be fun to talk about as well, and I will let you know at the beginning. All right, so that's it. Let's get to this week's guest.
Yeah. told her that she loved you much more than I did. Well, I know that she left you, and you swear that you just don't know why.
Janis Joplin had a very short career and short life, but she still fascinates us as a true rock and roll original. Of course, there is without doubt that powerhouse of vocal that sounds like it's about to fall apart, even as it soars above any of the music behind it. Certainly, her little girl blue life story is a huge part of her interest as well. It is mostly a sad account of a hugely talented and empathetic person who would never really find much happiness beyond the lighted stage. How can you not be endeared towards her and her story? Also, given the fact that she really was just getting started when she died of an accidental overdose, though not surprising in hindsight, it just makes the whole story a tragedy of epic scale. The promise of the life unlived. I'll prove the case by using only sample songs from her last album released posthumously, Pearl. The fact remains, she was special and continues to be a huge part of the rock and roll story. Not exactly the first rock and roll female star, Aretha Franklin, Tina Turner, or Big Mama Thornton and Sister Rosetta Tharpe come to mind as preceding her. And I might suggest Janis has a lot to owe to Wanda Jackson. But still, she became an overnight sensation. And I mean that quote unquote, after the Monterey Pop festival, and up until her death, was almost always on a rise in popularity. And I think the album Pearl was just going to make her even bigger, even if she had survived. It didn't matter that it was a posthumous album, is my point. I'm sure all of us would have liked to have seen and hear what would have happened if she had survived October 4th, 1970, but that's just speculation, looking at a crystal ball, if you will, and that doesn't do anybody much good. But we like to think, we like to consider what could have happened. I think that's a big part of her fascination as well. Many, many books have been written about Janis Joplin, some better than others. Most focus on the five-year arc of her rise and fall, and therefore are almost all incomplete. She did have a life before the San Francisco era, and she was much more than her music and her addictions. Well, now comes one of the most highly regarded chroniclers of American music history, and based on unprecedented access to Janis Joplin's family, friends, bandmates, archives, diaries, and even the long-lost interviews, Holly George Warren, who is our guest today, where we will dig into her new book, Janis, Her Life and Music, kind of has a new spin on things. And while I will have my time in just a minute to dive into the new biography on this legend, let me just have Roseanne Cash chime in on what she thought of the book. Quote, I've been waiting for the right person to write the definitive biography of Janis Joplin. All fans should be grateful it's finally here. Janis lives and breathes freedom and soul, and Holly George Warren captures that spirit perfectly, end quote. So, do you want to disagree with Johnny Cash's daughter? Yeah, me neither. Holly George Warren is a two-time Grammy nominee and the award-winning author of 16 books, including the New York Times bestseller, The Road to Woodstock with Michael Lang, and the biographies A Man Called Destruction, The Life and Music of Alex Chilton, and Public Cowboy Number 1, The Life and Times of Gene Autry. She's written for a variety of publications, including Rolling Stone, The New York Times, The Village Voice, and Entertainment Weekly, In addition, she has served as an archivist curator for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Foundation and the Grammy Museum. She is the director of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum Oral History Program and serves on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's nominating committee. She teaches art journalism at the State University there in New Paltz, New York. Oh, wow. She has got a CV. We'll talk about all of that and more, dive deep into her new book, Janice, Her Life in Music. So, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, I give you Holly George Warren.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train. And I was feeling near as faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained and rode us all the way into New Orleans. I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana. I was playing soft while Bobby sang the blues. Windshield wipers slapping time.
Holly George Warren, welcome to Deeper Digs in Rock. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great because I love Deeper Digs in Rock.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, we love having you here. We're going to dive deep into your new book, Janice, Her Life in Music. But I got to ask to start with, so what is the Holly George Warren superhero origin story?
Of myself or of Janice?
Of you.
Oh, me.
Your superhero story.
Well, I became a digging deep, obsessive rock and roll fan in third grade.
In third? Wow. All
back
the, third
in the
grade.
60s, a long time ago, during the golden age of AM radio.
That's right.
When I discovered in my teeny town in North Carolina that late at night when I was lying in bed, I could tune in my little pastel clock radio to WABC in New York or WLS in Chicago and get all these amazing tunes. And I literally became obsessed because in my town, you know, the radio station, which mostly played country and gospel, signed off.
North Carolina.
At night.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
it signed off at night.
Like,
it
was, like civilized people.
We're talking small town.
Right, right.
And suddenly I heard all this. And, you know, again, that was back in the day when you could hear a Johnny Cash song, then a Supreme song, then a Beatles song, then a Bobby Darin song. You know, I mean, it was just such a mix of music. And
yeah,
I
the
got
way AM
so
radio was at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah, you would get the Rolling Stones 1 minute and then you'd get Nat King Cole the next minute or
exactly,
something.
Exactly.
Like,
right? Yeah. And, you know, I mean, there was a few other places. Of course, I think I discovered American Bandstand around that time as well. Uh-huh. But I started using all my babysitting money
Clark,
to
right?
buy records.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my
mm-hmm.
parents got me. You know, record player. And then, so, you know, I bought a few albums, but mainly due to finances. I think I was getting paid 50 cents an hour as a babysitter. So I was buying lots and lots of 45s. So
right.
that really set me on my path
uh-huh.
and led me to where I am today.
Okay. Okay. Now, before we get into your excellent book on Janis Joplin, let's find out a little bit about your writing career, because this is not your first rock and roll rodeo, right?
No, I've been doing rock and roll books for a long time. In fact, when I did move to New York City to seek my fame and fortune as a music writer, I hope this was back in the punk era of cool fanzines you could write for and things like that.
Yeah.
One of my first jobs, and again, for a rock and roll trivia history geek, this was a dream come true. I got a job as a fact checker at the Rolling Stone offices. It was called Rolling Stone Press, and they were doing the Rolling Stone Encyclopedia of Rock and Roll. A big reference book on that very subject we know and love.
Wow.
And my gig.
The first one, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so my job was to read what these, you know, famous music writers from Rolling Stone, who I'd read as a kid.
Right.
You know.
Like David Fricke and.
No, this was pre-David Frick.
So like
yeah,
Hunter
this was
Thompson.
Like,
and...
No, he didn't really write about.
Yeah,
that
he wrote. Yeah,
this was
culture.
Like, I would say Dave Marsh is
Dave Marsh.
A major
okay.
one who wrote pieces for this. Mm-hmm. So I would read his essay or his little encyclopedia entry on Question Mark and the Mysterians, for example. And then I would get to call up Question Mark and double check that Dave got his facts straight about him. Did he really come from another planet? Did stuff like that. And it was incredible. You know, it was such a cool gig. I sat in this kind of loft type room with a bunch of other rock and roll geeks, and we listened to records all day, called people on the phone. And back in those days, this is around 1982, you know, there weren't very many sources to check. I mean, we could check back issues of Rolling Stone and Cream. And
yeah, it's not like the internet today where everything's at your fingers, right?
Exactly.
You actually had to go and put some shoe leather to work and
try to
go
find the people.
Yeah, call people, talk to people, and then libraries, I'm sure, and back pages, like you said, things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. So that was kind of my entree into publishing. And then I ended up eventually, which was kind of a cool thing, 10 years later, I came back to Rolling Stone. They hired me to be the editor with David Frick's colleague, a guy named Anthony DeCurtis.
Oh, Anthony DeCurtis, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
And then another guy who sadly we just lost, Jim Hinkey, who just passed away. I worked with them on the Rolling Stone Illustrated History of Rock and Roll and the Rolling Stone Album Guide. You know, I'd moved up the food chain. Now I was an editor with them. So I was getting to contact writers like Robert Palmer, the great blues scholar and writer, Grill Marcus from the Bay Area, of course, Robert Christgau, you know, many great, great
all
writers.
Those big guys.
Yeah. And talk to them about, you know, updating some essays they had written previously and then assigning new chapters. And Anthony, very cool thing, I thought, actually ended up assigning me to write a chapter for that book on women in rock and roll and some of the new artists, as well as looking back at Patti Smith and some of the groundbreaking artists from the 70s. So that was very cool.
Very awesome.
Yeah. And then that went well. That was a freelance gig. And then Jan Winter, who owned Rolling Stone, was thrilled with the books and decided to start up a book division again. It had gone defunct after my early foray there in the 80s. So he hired me to be the director of Rolling Stone Press. So for the next, say, 8-9 years, I did about 40 books while I was at Rolling Stone Press with a variety of publishers. We did beautiful coffee table books on Kurt Cobain, Jerry Garcia. Sadly, we used to call those our tombstone books.
I think I own both of them.
Yeah, beautifully designed books. And again, it would be an anthology of material that had been in the magazine, but then we would assign new pieces. So, for example, I got Ken Kesey to write a piece for Jerry Garcia, you know, things like that. So it was very cool.
Oh, that's nice. All right. So then you start doing your own books.
Yes, I started doing my own books. My first ever book was actually, I had two things happen to me at once. This was around 1990, before I went to work at Rolling Stone, even before I did that freelance gig editing those books. I got a deal to do a book with Jenny Boyd. She was previously married to Mick Fleetwood, and her sister Patty was married to George Harrison and Eric Clapton. So she had a little bit of contacts in the rock world, and she had gone back to school after she and Mick split up and gotten her PhD in psychology, and her dissertation was on the creative process in musicians. And she was really into Carl Jung and Abraham Maslow and, you know, just this kind of interesting study of the creative process. So she went to expand it into a book, and I had an agent and she connected us. So I became her co-author. So we ended up writing this book called Musicians in Tune, 75 Musicians Discuss the Creative Process. Fortunately, that was just an amazing experience working with her together, collaborating on the writing, doing the interviews, etc. And that book is actually was recently republished in England. So now it's got a different title. It's called It's Not Only Rock and Roll. So if you can't find the 1991 book, that one just came out a couple of years ago and we updated. And it's across the genre. We have everyone from John Lee Hooker to, Roseanne Cash to, of course, Joni Mitchell, Eric Clapton, Keith Richards, all the members of Fleetwood Mac, some very big names, talking about, you know, what it was like to be creative as kids, how they got into rock and roll, the collective unconscious, the peak experience as a performer and a songwriter, you know, these kind of heady subjects. But it's a cool book, I have to say. And then at the same time I was doing that, I was hired by Ben Fong Torres.
Oh, yep. Also Rolling Stone.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and featured in Almost Famous, of course, the film, and now a musical, I think, just opened.
Being worked on down in San Diego as we speak. Uh-huh.
So Ben had a book deal to write a biography of Graham Parsons, previously of The Byrds and the Flying Burrito Brothers, who tragically died in 73. And I was a huge Graham Parsons fan. So he hired me as his assistant. And basically through that job, I kind of learned how to write biographies because we went traveling all over the South, interviewing people. And, you know, he invited me to, you know, participate in interviews in Los Angeles. And I really learned about the art of not only writing a biography, which I was a huge fan of biographies, and I've been reading them, again, since I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
But now...
So along with the 45s, you also were a voracious reader of rock and roll lore.
Yeah, there weren't really that many to read until, I think, like around the 70s. The first one I remember reading was Anthony Scaduto's biography of Bob Dylan. Going way back.
Yeah.
And then gradually they started to be more available. People were getting deals. I mean, you know, they had this little teen quickie books and stuff. So, of course, I read some of those. But as far as the real books.
The serious books.
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
Right, that we get now. Like your book. Right.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, so those two projects kind of happened at the same time. And that's what led the way, I think, between that and then doing all the books at Rolling Stone. I kind of learned on the job.
Okay. All right. All right. And you now have 16 books published under your name, right?
Yeah, about 16 books. And, you know, that doesn't even include all these other kind of team projects that I did. I did a book with Martin Scorsese when he did a whole documentary series on the blues. I don't know if you remember that from the early aughts.
Yep.
And so I did the tie-in book with that. I got to work with Peter Guralnick on that. And so that was really cool. I did a book with Farm Aid for their... I think that was their 20th anniversary. I did a book with Bonnaroo for their 10th anniversary. So I also did these kind of books where I kind of put together teams of people to, you know, kind of like putting together podcasts or something to do a book. So I did those as well as doing my own books that I wrote.
Yeah. And you also teach, right?
Yeah, I teach at State University of New York in New Paltz, and I mostly teach...
New Paltz.
Yes. Arts writing classes, mostly,
All right, all right. Yeah, so a very nice breakdown of your CV. You are completely and utterly qualified. We have established that now, folks.
A legend in my own mind.
Well, I think it's more than just yourself here. So, thank you. So much has been written and said about Janis Joplin. So many books, several documentaries, Broadway, television. I think there's even been biopic attempts. So why a new book on her life?
You know, you would think, yeah, that everything had been said already, but I discovered from just my own work that I didn't know Janis's origin story, really. Like, how did she become a musician? How did she, this white girl in segregated Port Arthur, Texas, in the 50s, find these really difficult to find 78 recordings of Lead Belly and Bessie Smith, artists that turned her into a blues fanatic and set her on her path. And there was a little bit of information about that out there, but not a lot. So that was one of my motivations to kind of understand her musical journey. You know, Janis had such a colorful life. She created this incredible persona that we, you know, me included, believe to be, oh, that's Janis 100%. But I started getting this idea that there was a whole other side to her that we didn't know about.
Hmm.
Back in the early teens, I was asked to write liner notes for a 2-CD set called The Pearl Sessions by Sony Music. And what they did was they pulled out of the vaults from Columbia, her label, all these tapes of her in the studio with the producer Paul Rothchild.
Yep, working with the Doors and worked with her.
And famously quite the taskmaster when it comes to working in the studio. I had just done a project and interviewed a lot of the guys in the Doors and including the engineer Bruce Botnick, et cetera, and learned, like, you know, he would make Jim Morrison redo a vocal over and over and over again. And he was just very bossy. You know, famously, Joni Mitchell did a session and couldn't deal with him because he was trying to tell her what to do.
She went and ended up producing herself.
Yeah. But check it out. I think that's definitely what Janis would have done, because here's the thing. It turns out Janis was calling the shots on these tapes I was listening to. She was coming up with alternate, you know, ideas for arrangements than what they had started thinking about. She was coming up with guitar parts. She was calling the shots like, oh, wait, no, I want to redo this vocal. Wait, I want to change my vocal this way. She was really working in the studio as a peer with Rothschild. And come to find out, thank goodness for me, I got to collaborate as far as with the family, let me have access to these letters that she wrote home from San Francisco beginning in 66.
On her second trip to San Francisco.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, actually her third, believe it or not.
Oh.
Which I found out. She first hitchhiked to San Francisco when she was 18 years old. Check that out. And in 1961. But when she was there in 66, when she joined Big Brother, she would report home all these like studio geek, you know, details about working in the studio, what it was like to double track her vocals, explaining the process, what it was like, what the mixing process was like on Cheap Thrills. You know, she was really into that whole technical aspect of recording. And her persona, of course, was the complete opposite. She just made it look like she just was channeling this music from deep, you know, this pain.
Yeah, she just walked in like a diva, did her thing.
Yeah.
Left to go get her a bottle of Jack.
Yeah, or Southern Comfort or tequila. But she was such an amazing singer. I mean, she did almost make it seem effortless. But I discovered that there was this other side to her that she didn't want the public to know. She was a very, very hardworking musician, a student of music to begin with, who learned her phrasing, learned how to use her voice in all kinds of different ways, from just her natural, you know, born soprano that she sang in the church choir as a little kid or in the Glee Club in high school, you know, that she taught herself how to do different things with her voice, and then as a musician as well. And, you know, she started writing songs back in, like, say, 1962. You know, I think if she had lived, if she had not tragically died of an accidental heroin overdose while making Pearl, she would have gone on to be a producer. She would have continued to explore different musical genres. And if you do a deep dive into her catalog and go back to some things that now, thanks to the interwebs, you can hear some stuff of her doing everything from old-timey kind of hillbilly country music to Bessie. I mean, there's one song she wrote called Mary Jane that she recorded with a Dixieland jazz band in San Francisco the second time she was there in around 1964, where it sounds like a Bessie Smith song from back in the 20s.
Uh-huh,
it's this amazing song that Janis wrote. And I was fascinated by the secret life of Janis as a studious, hardworking musician.
More than just the persona that is cataloged and trotted out every so often.
Exactly.
Okay. Good reason to write a new book.
Yeah.
So now I interview a lot of rock and rollers. And honestly, while we do our best around here to get diverse voices, much of the rock and roll story is mostly men, certainly at the beginning and the formative years, though women do become more and more of the overall story as we get closer to the present. And inevitably, when I ask that eureka moment, these mostly guys, and they almost all point to either Elvis Presley or the Beatles as the lightning strike. And your book points to Janis as an inspirational moment in the lives of future women rockers. Why do you think that is?
Also, I would say male rockers, too. I don't think we would have seen Robert Plant's vocal style or his stage presence the influence of Janis Joplin.
Yeah, he is channeling some of her, isn't he?
Yeah, and he's said that himself. And actually, there is a woman who's a scholar and a musicological professor who's actually done a study comparing note to note some of a Janis track with a Led Zeppelin track. So you can read about that in my book. I mentioned that a little bit in there. But I think for women, there had never been an artist like Janis, who on stage was able to touch audiences the way Janis did, or probably men either, as when you think about it, as far as digging down so deep in herself and being able to touch these emotions, feelings, things that people try to keep tamped down, but we all kind of are keeping at bay. She was just letting them out through that incredible voice of hers, and also through her body. She was a very sensual performer.
Yeah, unabandoned on stage. Yeah.
Yes. And I mean, I've talked to people that saw her in 66, and they describe it to me as if it was a couple of weeks ago. It made such an impact on them. And that's everyone from, say, rock photographer Bob Gruen to many, many women. The great cinematographer Haskell Wexler, I just met his widow a couple of weeks ago at the Woodstock Film Festival. And she started telling me about seeing Janis with Big Brother and the Holding Company at San Francisco State in 1966. And she described it as completely changing her life. Same thing. She got to see them at Monterey Pop in 67, which was when
Janis becomes an international superstar.
Yeah, that's
overnight.
When she really got national attention, was her performance with Big Brother. And she said that the things that Janis was singing and the way she was expressing herself was able to help her reach into her own self and feel these emotions and things like that. So I think a lot of women in the audience felt that Janis was singing not only to them, but for them. She was voicing feelings that they had that they couldn't express themselves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. We're going to dive into her superhero origin story here. As many who know the Janis story are aware, her high school years were not kind to her. She was bullied. Famously, she returns for her Port Arthur High School 10-year reunion in 1970. And I think that was just a few weeks before her untimely death.
Yeah, it was about 6 weeks or 8 weeks before, yeah.
And if any have seen the video of her attending can see, you know, there's a lot going on under the surface.
Oh, yeah. It's sad to watch.
Her uncomfortability, even as a returning hero, is, I think, bittersweet at best. And I can imagine the conflicted feelings she must have had. But I didn't know that future NFL legend Jimmy Johnson was one of her tormentors.
Yes. That's correct. And I just have to preface it by saying that I think the reason what happened to her basically when she was in 11th and 12th grade, the last, couple of years or so of high school, I don't think it would have been so horribly painful if her earlier life in Port Arthur, her earlier school years weren't quite pleasant, quite happy. I mean, she was into the whole traditional kind of 50s school thing, really, up until... She was in her, around 14, 15, 16. And also keep in mind, Janis was much younger than most of her classmates. She started school at a very young age, and then she was so smart, she ended up skipping a grade. So she was emotionally quite a bit younger and smaller physically than a lot of the kids in her class. But what happened was in 1957, Janis discovered On the Road, which had just been published by Jack Kerouac.
Right.
And she also met some guys through the Little Theater Group, the summertime kind of thing to do for the arty kids. Some guys who were quite smart, who were intellectuals. Some of them actually were jocks. A couple of them played football and stuff like that. But she became kind of their mascot. They were all older than she was, but she was fascinated by them because they were into stuff that she wanted to know more about. You know, they were into Kerouac. They were into existentialism. Yeah. They liked to drive around and listen to the radio. And
the original counterculture, the Beats.
Yeah, they were like,
Beatnik,
Beatnik wannabes, kind of. Yeah. And so she
in
started,
Port Arthur, Texas.
Yeah, so, and she was so sharp. And they didn't even know she could sing because, you know what, Janis just kind of took it for granted that she had this pretty soprano voice because she just, whatever. She was wanting to be an artist. That's how she thought she could become special. And her goals at that point were to become, a painter, took paint art lessons. She was quite talented as an artist. She was very inspired by Modigliani. But while hanging out with these guys, that's when she ends up discovering Odetta, for example, and Leadbelly. And that's when she started working with her own voice and trying to sing in a different way by literally mimicking these records. And they're like, whoa. And before long, she's sneaking across the river to go to Louisiana with these guys and hang out at these roadhouses where as long as you can belly up to the bar, they'd sell you a drink, no matter how old you are. Right. If you're underage, didn't matter. And getting to hear what we call swamp pop, some of this cool R&B, swampy rock and roll stuff. And she just became a total obsessive about music and eventually would end up putting aside her paintbrushes and pastels and put everything into her music. Because of this, she started getting a bad reputation. It was, again, this was a very traditional conservative town. The other strike against her was, as you probably know, it was segregated then. Her school was all white.
Of course.
African Americans lived in this, you know, bad, you know, I mean, I saw it. I mean, it was still to this day, you know, dirt roads rather than paved streets, substandard housing, substandard, you know, school where they all had to go separately. And this was right around the time of Brown versus the Board of Education, which Texas was able to put off desegregation for a very long time after that ruling went down. Janice, however, stood up in social studies class and said, hey, I think, you know, black kids and white kids should all go to school together.
Yeah.
This is crazy. And that, again, made her persona non grata. Yeah. They did not like that. She started being called all kinds of epithets and you know, very racist things. And she loved black music. Now, fortunately, nearby Beaumont had a cool R&B station. So she started discovering some great music. Ivory Jo Hunter was from Beaumont. I mean, she had some stuff at her fingertips that she had to cross the color barrier to access. And again, a lot of the jocks didn't like that. And, you know, Jimmy Johnson himself wrote in his memoir and gave an interview to Sports Illustrated where he talked about, basically, he just kind of laughed about how much fun it was to basically bully Janis Joplin, that he and the jock buddies would call her names, and they had this nickname for her, Beat Weeds. You can kind of figure out where they kind of got that idea from. But they tried to make her life miserable, and poor Janis, with her last name being Joplin and his being Johnson, I think they sat next to each other in history class. So, where she got it.
It really affected her in a negative way. Maybe Jimmy Johnson and some of her other tormentors ought to rethink their values and what they were doing back then. But conversely, you expose her family as being really loving and even a bit musical themselves. So tell us about her parents and upbringing in Port Arthur in her family life.
It was very unusual because, yes, her mother had been a great singer herself as a teenager. Her senior year in Amarillo, Texas.
Right.
Yeah. And so she literally taught little Janice, who was basically an only child until she was six, how to sing and even to play on the piano when she was very young, like 2-3 years old. She started exposing her to music. And but her mom wanted a good life for Janice. She wanted that post-World War II prosperous middle-class white picket fence life for her daughter because she herself had a very unsettled childhood.
Yeah, growing up in the Depression and things like that, I'm
yes.
sure.
Yes, well, even affected. Pre-Depression, yeah. but yeah. yes, very much. And then Janice's father, she called a secret intellectual. He also was from Amarillo, Texas, had moved to Port Arthur to get a job in the booming oil industry during the Great Depression, got a kind of a mid-level management job. He had studied engineering in college, but had never completed college. He never got his degree, but was a very smart man. And he would come home from working all day and read history and philosophy. He listened to classical music like Bach. He also was an atheist, which was very
highly unusual at the time.
Yes. Yeah. And if you were, you didn't really make it known.
No.
So he did kind of keep it on
He'd
the down low.
He'd be called a commie after that.
Yeah. Now, Janice's mother came from a very religious family, evangelical Christian family. Janice herself was baptized by immersion in this first Christian church there. In fact, years later, they found in a church closet a paint-by-numbers Jesus at Gethsemane painting that Janice did. It's actually on exhibit in the very cool Museum of the Gulf Coast in Port Arthur, Texas. You can actually see that on exhibit. So she had these two very different ideas coming at her. But what they both had in common, her parents, were they really loved her and they really taught her to kind of speak her mind, to think outside the box, even though I don't think they had any idea that they were kind of creating
a monster. What they were setting up, right.
Yeah.
Right.
But they happily gave her, you know, art lessons. She was a real tomboy as a young girl. And the dad, I think, wanted a son. So since he didn't have one, he got one when Janice was 10 years old and her brother Michael was born. But at that time, he was building all these outdoor, you know, things that she could do, swing sets that were kind of dangerous. And she was really into climbing trees. She fell out of one and broke her arm. And she was a pretty rough and tumble kind of kid. The dad would take her with him to the barber shop on Saturday. He would take her to the library. She loved books, loved reading. In fact, she said, you know, in my family, as soon as you could sign your name, you would go get a library card.
Oh, okay.
He also used to take, I think this is kind of a cool thing to do. I mean, there was nothing to do, I guess, that much. He would take Janice and her friend down to the post office to look at the wanted posters on the wall. And so, of course, later Janice famously loved the Hell's Angels. So I'm wondering if that kind of planted the seed of, you know, the bad guys, you know, yeah, liking the Outlaws or whatever.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there is some advantages to at least being or looking like the bad guy.
Right. Exactly.
Sort of thing. All right. Now, as we talked about her love of black music, it seems like her friends, there were a couple of friends in high school that introduced her to, at the time, what is called race music.
Yeah.
And that's where her passion for the blues comes
about.
Yeah.
A couple of guys that she hung out with that were older, you know, turned her on first to Lead Belly, then Odetta. And then when she briefly went to college, you know, she graduated high school when she was 17.
Yeah, 1960. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and went to this nearby school, Lamar Tech, it was called at the time, in Beaumont. And most of the kids that went there, a lot of that were from Port Arthur. They were going to be in the petroleum industry. Janice, of course, wanted to be an art student. Mm-hmm. But while she was there, she actually discovered Bessie Smith. And through, I think he was an English professor who had some Bessie Smith records. Again, these are 78s. Bessie Smith, dead at this point and pretty much forgotten, even though she had been hugely popular, you know, Empress of the Blues in the 20s. But the Great Depression kind of wiped out her career. And so Janice really became obsessed with Bessie Smith. And that kind of took her on a journey, too, to find other blues recordings and learn these songs that were quite obscure. And this time, and, you know, we're talking early 60s, you know, there were some guys, white guys up in New England and out in California that were becoming blues scholars and going on these quests to find these old blues 78s. But you will rarely hear of any women on this kind of mission to discover these records. And
Right. That's
what Janice did. So by the time, you know, she had quite a few misadventures. I think I mentioned she was briefly out living in California in Los Angeles with an aunt. Then she went to try to be a beatnik and living in Venice Beach for a while. Then she hitchhiked to San Francisco for the first time all by herself when she was 18. She ends up back in Texas again, and eventually in 62, she goes to school in Austin, Texas, where she really found a tribe for her, you know, kind of interest, music, the beats, and she joined her first band called the Waller Creek Boys.
Yeah, interesting name for a band that's one-third female.
Yeah, well, they have already been playing some, you know, kind of Woody Guthrie folk and some bluegrass. It was Powell St. John. You might recognize his name. Later, he wrote songs for 13th Floor Elevators, mm-hmm. and then he also was in Mother Earth with Tracy Nelson. And he played harmonica, and a guy named Lanny Wiggins, who played guitar and banjo and sang. So they heard Janice's voice and were just blown away. So they asked her to join, become one of the boys. And they were shocked because she had this deep, deep knowledge of blues and R&B songs that she had learned. And so she started teaching them all that kind of stuff. So they were doing lots of roots music. I guess you could even call it Americana, what we refer to as Americana now, today, on campus, and then broke through and got all these fans at this really cool place called Threadgill's, which still exists in Austin. It had originally been a gas station started by this dude, Kenneth Threadgill, who loved Jimmy Rogers, the singing brakeman. You know, the father of
Jimmy
country
Rogers,
music.
That's right. Yep.
So they started performing there and built this fan base. So for the first time, Janice realized, hey, I want to be a musician. I don't want to just sing to my friends in the backseat of a car or sing along with the radio. I like
this
feeling.
On the biggest stage as possible.
Yeah. Right. She loved that feeling of people digging her voice and getting into her music.
It's
so
quite the drug, yes.
That totally set her on her path to become the Janis Joplin we all know and worship.
Okay, so before we get to, you know, San Francisco in the later 60s, 66 on, I just want to ask, there seems to be like two basic formative experiences for the American rockers. There's the reinventors of themselves, you know, people like Bob Dylan or Lou Reed, for example, who are, you know, standard middle class kids that then, you know, change their whole persona, their whole existence to become the people that we know them of now. And then there's the Born This Way types. And I think Janis fits more like on that side of things.
No, I would say definitely a little bit of both. I mean, speaking of Dylan, he was a huge influence on her. She discovered him when his first record came out and was really pretty obsessed with him. And she read Sing Out magazine, the little small magazine for folk music.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's weird. I actually found an interview with him from around that period of like 60, I think it was 62, something like that, 63, where, for example, someone interviewed him and said, you know, talk about your songwriting. He's like, oh, I don't write songs. I just make them up. I just pull them out of the air, kind of downplaying that. And then lo and behold, I find an interview with Janis from a couple of years after that, same kind of thing. Like, oh, I don't write songs. I just make them up, you know? And she loved Dylan. And in fact, cool thing that happened was in 1963, she left Austin and hitchhiked with Chet Helms, who will play a huge part in her career in 66. Mm-hmm. But at this point, he had dropped out of UT, was traveling around, also a big Kerouac fan. They go to San Francisco because Chet was convinced she would really make it on the folk circuit doing her Bessie Smith style blues.
Right.
So that was her first attempt to become a professional musician.
So that's why San Francisco, the first time, or the time she actually comes to live
there. She first moved there in 63 and, you know, didn't have anything, no infrastructure, no place to live, no money. But interestingly, she did make it to the Monterey Folk Festival where Bob Dylan performed. And at this point, he was still not very well known at all. And in fact, the show wasn't really getting that much traction until Joan Baez came out and said, hey, you guys, listen to this guy. He's got something to say, and did With God on Our Side, you know, with him. But anyway, Janis already was smitten with him and hanging out on the fairgrounds, actually bumped into him. And her friend Jay Whitaker, this woman who she was her lover at the time, who went with her to the festival, told me this great story that Janis goes up to Dylan and says, hi, I'm Janis Joplin. I'm going to be famous one day. And he said, yeah, we're all going to be famous one day.
Well, she won the golden ticket, so she wasn't BSing him.
Both ended up being on the same label, Columbia.
That's
they both
right.
ended
Albert
up being
Grossman,
managed by Albert Grossman. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, hey, I think she was telepathic.
Now, I've had the pleasure of speaking to Jorma Kaukonen several times, and we once talked about his working with Janis.
Love his stories about Janis. And you've probably heard the typewriter tapes.
Yes, I have. And that's the point. So there are these early recordings of them. And to Jorma, he says, look, they were just working out songs. That's why my wife was typing in the background. They're poor quality. And it's really just for sketching. But it still gives us a glimpse of what's to come, right?
Oh, yes. And, I mean, it's just such a great window, too, into where Yorma and Janice's heads were at that time. I mean, they were such kindred spirits talking about blues and, you know, these different songs, and just to hear their camaraderie while they were working out these songs. And then, but even you could see into the future, there's this one little bit you can hear when they're talking, and she starts talking about wanting to have a gold lamé dress and, you know, to wear on stage in front of this velvet curtain. Now, this was
like the Supremes or something like that. Right,
and this is a time when Janice was a total beatnik. And the way she looked on stage, she would either wear some men's shirt, like this huge oversized, like button down the front men's shirt, no bra, which was scandalous in those days, of course. We're talking 63.
Right.
You know, dungarees or Levi's, you know, worn out, a lot of times barefooted. Or if she dressed up, it would be like, say, a black turtleneck and Levi's or something like that.
Oh, the standard beatnik dress.
Yeah, totally. Mm. Her hair just hanging down. You know, really no Janice that we know of as being this amazing, you know, feather boa,
well,
incredible.
She's still kind of playing acoustic music at this point.
Yeah,
right?
She had learned how to play auto harp in Austin with the Waller Creek Boys. She was teaching herself guitar. She learned a little bit from, you might know the name, Tom Hobson, who was a renowned guitarist in the Bay Area. She took some lessons from him and managed to put enough tips for, you know, open mic night tips together to buy an acoustic at a pawn shop. So she's trying to get better on guitar. But, you know, to hear her with Yorma, you know, she was only at that point, she was, I think, 22 years old or something like that. Wait, let's see, 40. No, she was 20. She was 20 years old.
Yeah.
This was 63. And to hear her ideas for the future and just to hear them working together. And I so enjoyed talking to Yorma about Janice. And of course, you know, in 66, they would cross paths again when he was in Jefferson Airplane and she was with Big Brother. But I think that time when they worked together and her voice then was his favorite of all the Janices that we've gotten to hear, you know.
So things don't go well on her first trip here, her first living experience here, and she's forced back home after acquiring a severe drug habit.
Yeah, it started out pretty good. I mean, because again, like Chet Helms said, she knocked their socks off. You know, things went quite well in the beginning. She really impressed all kinds of people with her voice and got bookings all over the Bay Area and even apparently some label interest. But it was a very, very difficult life. I mean, think about it. This was 63. She was a lone woman, no infrastructure. She was booking her own gigs, either hitchhiking or eventually getting a little moped to get around, and no place to live, you know, living hand to mouth. And it was tough. It was scary. And yeah, she had started drinking and she started popping pills.
Mostly amphetamines.
Yeah, right? Purple Hearts, they were called. Now, these were quite available back in those days. College kids had them. She first tried them in college to study for exams and things like that. So horribly, things deteriorated. She ended up actually leaving San Francisco, spending the summer of 64 in New York City, where she mostly made money by being a pool shark. She was an amazing pool player.
Really?
So she was able to hustle up a lot of pool games. That's how she made money. But around that period, she was introduced to methamphetamine, which she began injecting.
Ugh.
And it was very prevalent, both the Lower East Side and the Bay Area in that period. A lot of people, I mean, the famous Owsley, he was first as the chemist of methamphetamine before he perfected LSD. So it was quite available. Sadly, she got so into it that singing fell by the wayside and she was down to 88 pounds, close to death. And her friends put her on a Greyhound bus.
Sent her home.
Yeah, May of 65, she went back to Texas.
So what do you think is the most important takeaway from her first, you know, largely unsuccessful trip out west?
Well, I wouldn't even count it as largely unsuccessful in that, because I think it was a very important first step for her to make it as a musician.
Uh-huh.
And she actually met some people like Yorma, Jerry Garcia, even her future bandmate, Peter Almond, who formed Big Brother and the Holding Company in 65. He was on that same folk circuit. He was on a live radio show in Berkeley with Janice and first saw her sing up close and personal. She was on folk bills with Nick Gravanitis, the great Chicago songwriter, blues singer, who later would play an important role in her life. And of course, Chet Helms, who would be very instrumental in her return in 66. So I think she was laying some groundwork that she wasn't perhaps physically, emotionally ready to do on her own at that point. And you know what? I ended up interviewing some other women who tried to make it as folk singers, and rarely did any of them be able to pursue it because it was such a difficult life.
Oh,
it was,
especially for women. Yeah.
It was dangerous.
Yeah.
There was no money. There was, you know, it was hard. It was really hard. And the rare exceptions were, you know, people like Joan Baez, who, you know, had a label, you know, who was huge, the queen of folk. And she was doing a very different kind of music than this white girl singing the blues.
Right. Yeah.
You know, Janis was, you know, carving her own path, which was very, very different from the popular folk singers of the day.
The folk community.
Yeah. They were doing.
It was very much a community.
You know, people wanted to sound like Joan Baez.
Yeah.
And Janis was kind of growling and rasping and had this alto and doing songs about lowlives and chiselers and bad men, you know, Bessie Smith songs.
Right. So she goes home, sobers up, and attempts to live a normal expected life back in Texas. But it doesn't take, does it?
She can't stop the music that's in her. You know, it was just too much a part of her. And she did fear for her life. She knew how close to death she had come, and that,
because,
you know,
of the drugs. Yeah, 88 pounds.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, speed is a very, very deadly drug. And she was afraid. And her mother, of course, her parents, you know, clearly wanted to save her life. And they thought that this music thing was really bad for her. So we're trying to steer her away from it. But she couldn't help it. She started writing songs again. She wrote Turtle Blues, which is, you know, we know from Cheap Thrills. Mm-hmm. Finally, she starts performing again. She'd gotten better on guitar so she could accompany herself and at coffee houses in Beaumont and also in Houston, where Townes Van Zandt and Guy Clark and some others were starting to perform. Uh-huh. So she ended up back singing at some different concerts and things in Austin, Texas. And again, getting a lot of support from her audiences, some music journalists who could see in her this incredible talent. But, you know, look at the time period. This was now 65, 66. And guess what? The Beatles had hit.
Yeah. Now things go electric.
Folk music was starting to fall by the wayside and people were playing in bands. Janis was still doing the folk thing. But guess what? She heard this band called 13th Floor Elevators with this guy named Rocky Erickson, who had this, shrieky, piercing, banshee wail. And she's like, So yet again.
Yeah, she said, I can do that.
Right. So next thing you know, Chet Helms, working with Big Brother and the Holding Company, who've decided that they want to have a girl singer like Jefferson Airplane and the Great Society, a couple of bands. So he's like, I know just the ticket. So he sends his friend Travis Rivers to come from San Francisco to Austin, where Travis was from and already knew Janis, to retrieve her and take her back to San Francisco to jam with Big Brother, and the rest is history.
So before we go there, I have to ask about the Peter DeBlanc marriage proposal in 1965.
Well, I think just as evil and deadly as her speed addiction was, and was this guy that she met around that same period in 65 in San Francisco, who was, I mean, you could make a Netflix series about this guy. He was a con man, and he conned her into believing he was in love with her and wanted to marry her, that he was from this rich family in upstate New York, and that he, you know, he created this whole false identity. He had this, you know, crazy resume that was all fabricated, et cetera. He was a smart guy. He was a pathological liar. He had a wife and kid. He had other women in his life, but he somehow convinced Janis that she was the one for him and that they were going to get married and she was going to have this white picket fence that her mom had always wanted her to have. So they started this correspondence because she was back in Port Arthur. And oh my gosh, getting to read those letters is so, so incredible, to just see Janis basically trying to take stock of her life to that point, looking back at things that she had done in her life, decisions she'd made, looking to the future. And it's just so eye-opening to really understand Janis and try to get into her head.
Yeah, yeah.
Because she wrote him like something like 70 letters over about a four-month period. And they're just amazing documents. They function pretty much like journal entries.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, she finally figures out that the guy's a total cad, con man. And I think he hustled money out of the family. But they break it off, and she then just fully goes back into music again at that point.
So, and I bring that up because, you know, kind of like the torment of high school, these are psychic hits that are really, you know, taking a toll in her, who, by all accounts, you know, is a sweet, nice, intelligent woman.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing about it. Like, you know, she was popular and, you know, fairly, you know, well-loved in her school in Port Arthur. And then they turned against her in Austin, Texas. Got this big following. People thought she was, you know, the greatest thing ever. And then these horrible guys in this fraternity nominated her as the ugliest man on campus.
That's right.
And put her face up on these posters. Now, she did not win. That's been falsely reported.
Mm-hmm.
A linebacker from the football team won. But still, that was so hurtful to her. Then here we go again. You know, this guy who's like madly in love with her. And I mean, it's just heartbreaking to read her letters to him, like, you know, saying things like, oh, Peter, you're the first guy to ever write me a love letter. And, you know, she had some insecurities about her looks. I mean, I personally think she was gorgeous. But, you know, she wasn't like a cheerleader beauty queen type, which was kind of the, you know, the bouffant hairdo and the makeup and all that.
No, like she was her own woman.
Yeah.
And she exuded her own sexuality,
60s, yeah.
Which was not expected at the time.
Yeah, exactly. So she kept, you know, it's like building you up just to knock you down.
Yeah.
It was that kind of painfulness that I think made her really mistrust love interests and relationships that
and
she was in. Yeah.
Self-medicating.
And again, she was shy. It took a long time for the Waller Creek Boys to actually get her to perform live. And she had to guzzle down a few beers or some, you know,
liquid
some
courage,
jug wine,
right,
or whatever to get it going. And the same kind of thing with Big Brother. She overcame that. You would never in a million years guess that she had any sort of stage fright or fear because of she was such a phenomenal dynamic performer. But, you know, she did.
So in 1966, she heads back to San Francisco at the urging of Chet Helm and joins as a singer for a band he also manages, Big Brother and the Holding Company. So did it take an electric group to make her an electric singer?
Oh, yeah. She, again, wrote letters and talked about the transformative effect on her of singing in front of really loud guitars where she couldn't even hear herself. I mean, you know, hey, there were no monitors then. There was barely any PAs, know?
Sound reinforcement was not invented at that point.
And again, that's why I say that if she hadn't been on this musical journey going all the way back to her late teens as a singer, you know, she had great pitch. You listen to some of those San Francisco bands and most of the vocals were,
rather raggedy.
Yes. And she could freaking hit the notes, you know? She didn't have
and
to
just
hear herself. She could
she knew her inner placement.
Voice.
Right. Yeah. She knew placement in her vocal
exactly.
Chords.
But she got a whole new toolkit
as
far as a vocalist goes. I mean, you know, again, as I mentioned before, she has already experimented with different styles of singing, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But now she was adding some a little Rocky Erickson, Banshee Wail to her gospel testifying, to kind of going back to rock and roll Little Richard stuff. She loved Little Richard as a teenager. You know, you can hear a lot of influences coming in that she hadn't expressed before in her singing in order to be heard over this loud two guitar attack, bass and drums. And in the beginning, she wasn't even the lead singer. She was just singing maybe three songs, four songs.
Right, right.
It was a very democratic band. And with this communal idea, Peter Albin, the bassist, sang most of the lead, but Sam Andrews sang some. James Gurley, the other guitarist, sang some. They all brought material to the group to work up. And so it was just a very gradual evolution that she even started singing on most of the songs after they became huge at Monterey Pop. But before that, she was doing a lot of backup vocals. And even that was an interesting new thing for her She had, of course, done some harmony vocals with some of the folk groups and doing her blues stuff with her accompanists. But now she was using her voice in different ways to sing and make almost like sound effects. She was learning how to play these cool percussive instruments. So again, she was expanding her musical repertoire.
Okay, so now she's in the burgeoning San Francisco music scene that she will rule over in about a year or so. So how much of her success is based on that timing?
Oh, number one, I think this was the happiest period of Janis Joplin's life. Wow. From that, you know, catching on early, you know, before it was, she was a nationally known name.
Oh yeah, this is pre-Summer of Love.
This
and,
was
and
this was like
that,
the real Summer of Love.
Yeah,
like
66 is actually
before
the real
media
summer.
Found out about it. The real Summer of Love was definitely like late 65 into 66. And it was
by summer of 67. It's way over, and it's actually a health hazard.
But this period, there were all these great little small, you know, gatherings and free concerts outside, and she was part of this whole community. And even though she had found her tribe of like-minded people, it was still such a crazy eclectic group of people that were, you know, they were all hanging out together, from, you know, people from the Beats to the Hell's Angels. I mean, Big Brother was like their mascot band, to people like the Zen Buddhists, to, you know, of course, all the psychedelic bands. And then, of course, people who had started bands like Grateful Dead that she'd known from that period when she'd been there before on the folk scene. And they all just really supported each other. It was such a new thing. It was so exciting. And also just all the different parts of it, like the way people were dressing and finding crazy, you know, vintage stuff in thrift shops and using bits of clothing from other countries, you know, from around the world, and creating this whole look and making beads and, you know, creating this persona, which is what she gradually was doing under the influence of all these new friends of hers, and building a following of just people that just hung on her every word, you know, ran up to the lip of the stage to hear her sing. And that kind of confidence boosting, and then that kind of community and camaraderie, I think really permitted her to blossom as a singer and to continue to challenge herself as a musician. It made it more difficult for her to eventually leave the band, because she wanted to pursue other kinds of music. She wanted to sing different ways that she couldn't do if she stayed with Big Brother and the Holding Company. So that made it yet again another torturous kind of turn in the road, where people that loved her so much in San Francisco would then completely turn on her.
Yeah.
In 1968, 69, when she left Big Brother.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute. But I have to bring up another huge influence to her that I think just makes a total difference in her as a performer, and that is Otis Redding.
He was the number one for her that up until the end of her life. She always cited Otis Redding as being her major influence, her favorite singer. Mm-hmm. And of course, she had discovered those records, which were not well known outside the R&B audience. As early as, you know, 65, 66, she started hearing his music and loving it. But when she saw him in the fall of 60, I think it was December of 66, did a three-night stand
here at
the Fillmore. She was a sponge, absorbing his stage presence, his sexuality. He had this eroticism, the way he performed, and he just had the audience in the palm of his hand. And she totally took that and kind of made it part of her own presentation on stage. And then also even just some of his vocalization tricks she started picking up, you know, the way he would kind of do this kind of soulful stuttering of certain syllables and things like that. She started incorporating that kind of sound into her own, which, you know, ironically, then later on, I think Robert Plant kind of took some of her vocalization styles that she had adapted from, you know, Otis Redding for his own style. You know, it keeps going on, you know?
Yeah. You know, that's the second time that Plant's come up here. And I completely agree with you. What she has vocally, especially in the early rock and roll piece here, is that her frequency level is able to sit on top of those twin guitars there with Big Brother, just as like Robert Plant will do with Jimmy Page. She has that wail. He has that wail that can cut through the frequencies that sit with the six-string electric guitar.
Yeah, and we'll later see it with Steven Tyler and Aerosmith. Yeah, we'll see it with, you know, even David Johansen, of who was in the New York Dolls in the 70s, always points back to Janis as a big influence, you know, to be able to sing over that, you know, Johnny Thunders, Sylvain Sylvain, you know?
Yeah. All right. Of course, her worldwide coming out party occurs in 1967 when she's one of the performers at the all-important Monterey Pop Festival. So what happened to make her an overnight sensation?
Well, they weren't really that well known outside of the Bay Area, Big Brother and the Holding Company, and Janis certainly had no separate billing. She was just one of the guys, right? So the promoters of the festival wanted to be sure and have the cool San Francisco sound represented at their festival. And famously, these guys, you know, Lou Adler and John Phillips were from the LA scene. So there was an early Saturday afternoon slot for this unknown band, Big Brother and the Holding Company. Well, that all changed when Janis Joplin opened her mouth and people were literally, as the British like to say, gobsmacked.
Right, right.
They could not believe the sound coming out of her. And it worked so well with her band, with Big Brother and the Holding Company. I mean, it was such a great unit, the way they worked together. But the focal point became Janis after that. Now, funnily enough, they were not filmed
as many
of the bands were, because the San Francisco acts did not trust these LA slickies, and they refused to sign off the paperwork giving permission to be filmed. D.A. Pennebaker, the late, great documentary filmmaker who we just lost, you know, had done Don't Look Back with Dylan, which, of course, Janis had seen. All these heavy hitters were there. Albert Grossman, Dylan's manager, who was working with Michael Bloomfield and Paul Butterfield, who were performing. Pennebaker went nuts. We've got to have this girl in our film. If you got to break somebody's arm to get her in it, we got to do it. So this whole thing went down where there was a big fight among their former Mary Prankster manager, Julius Carpin, who demanded that they not be filmed because, you know, they were being ripped off, to Janis, who wanted to be famous, wanted to make it. So it was this huge fight. Eventually, Janis won, and the producers gave them another time slot the next day, Sunday evening, which was a much more prominent spot, to play another set. This time it was filmed. So at this point, all these journalists from all over the country, from the UK, who had been brought in to write about the show.
The Who and all that were coming up.
I mean, Janis was the headlines in a lot of the coverage because she was such a shock. There'd been no hype or anything like that. And people just were blown away. So this event led to their eventually signing with Albert Grossman as their manager. And he eventually was able to get them out of their first record deal with a small label called Mainstream that hadn't really done much for them, but had locked them up into a 5-year contract. And Clive Davis, who had just recently become the president of Columbia Records, was there.
That's right.
Totally, you know, among those who was just blown away by Janis. And of course, he ended up coming up with a ton of money to break the deal with Mainstream and sign them to Columbia, which would happen in 1968. All this kind of took a few months to come to pass. But by then, you know, Janis's star had risen. She was becoming the feature of lots of media coverage, and she was really being singled out, and her band was kind of treated more like backup players rather than her bandmates.
Well, in analyzing that ourselves, there's a huge difference in talent between Janis and the other players of Big Brother. She kind of outgrows them very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, they were great at what they did. And personally, being a punk rocker myself, I love their kind of, I mean, they had this real pre-punk kind of garage band energy. They call themselves freak rock, you know? So I have to say, I really love
Cheap Thrills. I think the cover is actually put together by the fabulous Freak Brothers, right?
Well, it was done by Robert Crumb.
Yeah, Robert Crumb.
So, who was a friend of Janis's, and she's the one that got him to do it. But again, Janis was a restless soul when it came to her music. She wouldn't stay in one place for too long. She had to move on. She had to do other kinds of music that, yes, Big Brother, it was not in their wheelhouse to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, what became her fate only a few short years later, was that best for her? You know, leaving Big Brother and moving on. I mean, she had this community. She was the singular superstar in it. She knew and had people that she could trust. And now she's going to move on and she doesn't have that support structure anymore.
Yeah, it was hard for her at first. Also, it was a real learning process to become a band leader. And that wasn't something that you could just do overnight
No.
So she really didn't have time. It was unfortunate with, she had some great players, but it was unfortunate with the, what was later known as the Cosmic Blues Band, that they couldn't really organically gel as a group before they were already out on the road performing. And but I don't think that band has gotten the credit due to them, because there was some incredible things that they did together. And you can, again, see Janis's evolution as a band leader and also branching out and doing different styles of music on I Got Them Old Cosmic Blues Again, Mama, which I think is a really underrated record. I think it's got some amazing stuff on there.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of my favorite Janis songs ever is Cosmic Blues, which, of course, is on that record,
yeah,
which came out 50 years ago. And it still sounds really good. I think people need to go back and listen to that one. But by the time she had moved on from that group and got together with the guys who became the Full Tilt Boogie Band,
right,
I think she got back some of that camaraderie, communal vibe that she had from Big Brother, but also, you know, some of the chops, some of the musicianship that she was looking for to be able to accompany her musical visions.
Yeah, yeah. I agree that each iteration, the musicianship gets better. But at the same time, she's kind of sacrificing this, you know, this camaraderie that she had. It's good to hear that she got some of that back with Full Tilt Boogie.
She was a brave person. She was fearless, even though it was really hard and really scary. She basically did that her whole life. I mean, if you just look back and see the way that she would take these turns on the road that would alienate her former safe, stable life, but she had to. I mean, part of it, maybe it was reading Kerouac. Part of it was her family instilling her this way of thinking that you have to follow what you think is right. You have to make something of yourself. You have to continue to work towards something, to work toward goals, you know, whatever it was that drove her. It made for a very disruptive personal life. It made it very hard to have, you know, be in a relationship, etc. But she made those decisions, and she bravely forged on, even though it was very painful.
Mm. So now you also dive into the obvious rampant sexism of the music industry of the age and how it affected Janis in particular, right?
Yes, she, of course, broke down a lot of barriers.
Yeah.
It didn't mean that they didn't keep trying to put them up for her. And again, people, I think younger people today don't realize how rare it was to have a woman like Janis Joplin with the kind of music that she was doing, putting herself out there like she did, like bearing her soul and doing it in a very kind of physical way, very sexual. And also, she was very, very outspoken about her ideas. She was behind the scenes doing things like, I just met David Smith of the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic, and he was telling me about that she helped actually very early on starting some support systems for women who had been sexually assaulted, who got pregnant accidentally, mm-hmm. things like that, mm-hmm. some women health issues that made women have, you know, it was a very risky time for women. And Janis had to deal with some of that same stuff herself. With the music business, the same kind of thing. She wasn't your typical little frothy, you know, pop star type. And it took a lot to...
Now, she could hang with the boys.
Oh, yeah.
No problem.
Oh, yeah. So she had to put up with a lot of that. And I that's why I do think she would have continued on and become a producer, because at this period of time, hardly any women got to produce their own records or anybody else's records.
Right, right, right. In fact, I think it was all men at that point.
Yeah.
So, you know, she has this lifelong pursuit for a partner and an intense desire for a living relationship that just never really materializes for her, right?
Yeah, there's this really telling conversation that was recorded by the great journalist David Dalton on that Festival Express train tour of the summer of Canada. 70. Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Janice is discussing their lives with Bonnie Bramlett, who was on the road with her husband, then husband. And Janice says to
Bonnie
her,
Delaney, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Janice says to her something like, you know, music is the only thing that's real. It's the only thing that lasts. I mean, something to that effect. Mm-hmm. Like, you kind of have to give it all up because no man is ever going to do for me what music does for me. And again, I think that's true, that the music was so much a part of her that it was the only real thing in her life that never let her down. You know, people betrayed her constantly. People turned against her constantly. But the music never did. And she wanted to be a musician, and she had to sacrifice her own personal happiness for that pursuit.
Yeah, a life filled with lovers, but nobody of, you know, complete significance that she would call, you know, a real relationship,
and
a
it
real
wasn't,
partner.
Yeah, and she did not reject those ideals. I mean, she...
No, not at all. She desired them.
Yeah, she told the guys in Full Tilt Boogie when they were recording Pearl, they would go to Barney's Beanery and hang out and knock back a few, and she would talk about wanting to get married, wanting to have a kid, and she would make these attempts to get married and settle down and things like that. But things just didn't work out that way.
No, it seems like her life is just one long blues record.
But the thing is, though, what we have to remember is she was only 27 years old.
Right, when she passed.
How many people out there have settled down, especially these days?
Well, maybe, not today.
Yeah, but maybe, but, you know,
there was an expectation back then.
Yeah, so she was, but she was pioneering new roles and lifestyles for women. Mm-hmm, hey, you know? Mm-hmm,
yeah.
So what she was doing then, perhaps, was going to be part of a maturation process and evolution. Maybe when she was in her mid to late 30s, she would have settled down. Maybe she would have had a kid. Look at Yoko Ono, you know?
Yeah.
So there were a few women that were seeing things differently then. And, you know, Joni Mitchell comes to mind.
Yeah.
That they knew that they could not follow their muse as artists, as musicians, and be in this relationship at that very vital period of their artistic evolution. And that's where Janice still was. She was just beginning her musical evolution. She still had a long way to go. So I like to hope that eventually, had she lived, she would have eventually found some sort of stable relationship that she could have had happiness with and still been an artist, still been a musician. And I think it would have taken a special kind of person, male or female. She was
She was fluid, right?
Yeah, she was fluid, polyamorous. But I think she liked having that close relationship. And she had some very good friends that she stayed in touch with for long periods of time, that she wrote letters to, etc. So it wasn't like she was one of those people that just couldn't connect with others, because she certainly could.
It just seems like, you know, her life is just filled with a lot of hope and promise, but in the end, so much disappointment, as her father said, the Saturday Night Swindle.
Right, which was her version of what she turned it into, cosmic blues.
Yeah.
That same kind of existential dark philosophy that, hey, you know, when you do realize, like, life is not just a bowl of cherries, you know, things can be going really great for you, and then all of a sudden the rug is pulled out from under, or, you know, a disappointment, a loss. I mean, life has a lot of slings and arrows, as Shakespeare liked to say. But, you know, the thing is, you get used to that when you hit your 30s and your 40s, and the older you get, you learn to deal with those kind of things.
Your skin gets thicker, right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. She never got the chance to get to that part because, horribly, tragically, she accidentally overdosed on very strong heroin that happened to come her way when she relapsed after being clean for several months.
Yeah. In the end, she only has these few short years, and she dies at 27, as we said, from an accidental overdose at the Landmark Hotel on October 5th, 1970, while she's completing her next album, Pearl, right? Which, had she lived, would have made her on top of almost all the rock acts in the world.
Yeah, it was actually October 4th that she died, but it was at 1 o'clock in the morning. So she actually, you know, they found her that night. It was a Sunday night. Yeah. But Janis would have continued doing, I think, all kinds of music. I think she would have had more successes. It was me and Bobby McGee that gave her, I think it was like the second time in pop history there was a posthumous number one.
Yeah, Otis Redding was the first.
Yeah, Dock of the Bay, which, how poetic is that?
It is.
And of course, she was devastated when Otis Redding died in a plane crash when he was a very young man. I think he was 29, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, hey, there's a lot of casualties in rock and roll. Buddy Holly, one of the first.
It's a dangerous profession.
Richie Valens, only 17 years old. Yeah. It is dangerous. And Janis knew what she was getting into. She knew how dangerous it was. But you know what? She did it anyway.
Didn't matter. The passion was what drove her. So why do you think her music is so endearing? We're talking about a woman who died almost 50 years ago now. And who do you think you find as her musical children today?
I think there are a lot of her musical children. Everyone from, say, you know, Brittany Howard to Alicia Keys have actually talked about her influence. Alicia Keys talked about how she was able to express this inner emotion, that it's so hard to take yourself to that place and do that. It's a scary thing to do. Stevie Nicks, when she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame
last year,
earlier in this year, she talked about seeing Janis, getting to open for her in San Francisco, seeing the connection she was able to make with her audience completely changed her life and made her want to do that too. Then there's other artists, Kate Pearson of the B-52s, same kind of thing, to have that incredible performance style, to, you know, be able to use your voice in all these different unusual kind of ways. I think the list just goes on and on and on. Florence Welch, Florence and the Machine, she's been able to reach women of all genres, all different eras, that once they hear this music, I think it gives them a boost to think, I can do this. I want to carve out my own style. I want to carve out my own sound. I want to do this no matter what it takes, what the costs are. I've got to do this. I think that's one of the things. Now, as far as Janis's music, her great legacy, hey, it still sounds amazing today. And I teach college, and I love seeing my students' faces when they see the performance on YouTube of Big Brother and the Holding Company doing Ball and Chain and Monterey Pop. You know, that kind of authentic music expression, that kind of talent, that kind of passion is still a rarity to this day. I mean, there's never been an artist performer like Janis Joplin, and there's been a lot of good ones, but no one just like her. I think she broke the mold.
So lastly, let's pull the lens back a little bit more. And why do you believe we all still care about Janis and the other giants of this musical age?
Well, I think because the music holds up, it stands the test of time, to use a cliche. Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of music that's fun, great music that you go back and listen to it and it really has its place in that period of time, et cetera. But it doesn't have that timeless quality. And I think, again, because Janis herself went back, she went back to music from the 20s. In the 30s, to inform her own style. So she's part of this musical spectrum, I think, that makes it have this substance and this depth and this quality that makes it still really reach us emotionally. And that's the thing about music. You know, there's probably nothing else that affects us the way music does. It touches our emotions so strongly that, you know, we can hear a song maybe 30 years later and suddenly it takes us back to this feeling, that moment where that song was part of our life. And I think Janis's way of expressing her own music does that as well.
the language of the universe. So what's next up in the rock and world for you?
Well, I am hoping to possibly do a beautiful photo book of Janis Joplin, because I discovered in researching this book, there's amazing photography out there. A lot of the images have never been seen, but photographers loved her. Mm-hmm. Everyone from Richard Avedon to Irving Penn to, of course, all the great rock photographers, Jim Marshall, Baron Wallman, yeah. And yeah. On and on and on. There's a lot of great stuff that's never been seen. And again, I think there's still such an interest in her, but just her visual presentation was a huge influence, even on our style today, et cetera, been a huge influence on women. I'm also working on a documentary film about Nudie, the rodeo tailor.
Oh, yeah.
Most known for everything from
Graham
Elvis.
Parsons' jackets. And
He did the Gilded Palace of Sin cover, costumes on the cover. Also was known for doing Elvis's gold lamé suit back in the day. He did all the great Hank Williams suit with the musical notes on it, and actually even made outfits for Janis Joplin.
Wow. So it is, you're still on the Janis Joplin train here.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good.
Once I have someone in my life as my biography subject, and this is number three, they never go away.
Oh, good, good, good. Well, we look forward to seeing more of this. So, Holly George Warren, thanks so much for being with us today on Deeper Digs in Rock.
Well, I love talking to somebody who's into this stuff as much as I am.
Thank you. Thank you. We will have you back, I'm sure.
I'd like to do a song. Yay. Great song. I'll count on that. For it. It goes like this. Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. So, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Dialing $4 is trying to find me. I'll wait for delivery.
Wow. Thank you for coming by the studio and spending the day with us, Holly George Warren. We had a lot of fun. Her new book, Janis, Her Life in Music, is out and available now. Obviously, it would make a great holiday present for any of you rockers out there. So go get it wherever you find your good reads. All right. Between 1967 and 1970, Janis Joplin was a rising star. And then at 27, she was gone. She made only three albums in her life, two with Big Brother and one with the Cosmic Blues Band. Of course, she was working on what would become Pearl at the time of her death. There was only one single, Piece of My Heart, that charted into the top 40 during her lifetime. And only the Kris Kristofferson penned Me and Bobby McGee made the top 40, reaching number one after she was gone. That's not a lot of material to hang your hat on. Granted, she was a dynamic and fearless performer. That was obviously her real strength. She took the Otis Redding act and, kind of like what Aretha did with the song Respect, Janis turned that male sexuality exuded from the stage and turned it on its head. And we know that persona that she created was about as opposite as she was offstage. This does make her compelling. But I might ask, does she really deserve all these accolades, all of the books and movies, a stage show, and documentaries? I mean, Aretha has a giant career with far more musical impact than Joplin ever achieved. And while we can't predict what Janis would have become had she not ended up gone on October 4th, 1970, I'm not sure she would have been able to navigate the waters of rock stardom in the 1970s regardless. Maybe, but her personal demons would, I think, always be there to help destroy her ambitions. I bring this up because I've had
personally, a complicated relationship with her since I was a baby rocker all those years ago. At first, I found her voice shrill and too raw when I heard it. But then, seeing her dynamo performances on video made me reassess. She was certainly magnetic on stage. Now, I've read several of the books on her and seen the Little Girl Blue documentary. And now I've read Holly George Warren's book. And I guess because everyone is still trying to figure something out, I guess that's what makes her so compelling. I get the Lord Byron treatment of the artist with so much promise taken from us before proving they were worth their early accolades. This is all really just a big thought experiment, and maybe I'm just having it with myself, but I can't help feeling that Janis Joplin, while worthy of inclusion into the overall pantheon of rock and roll, isn't and shouldn't be sitting at the right hand of, say, Chuck Berry and Elvis. And I wonder if all this brain power going into Janis over the years isn't better served shining lights in other directions. Now, maybe it is the unfortunate reality that Janis was unique because she was the lone woman and lone white woman, I mean, that achieved the same level of respect as the men of her time. She shouldn't have been, I think, is part of my point. And if there were a few others around her at the time, she would be less of a unicorn. Of course, maybe that is the appeal, especially for women rockers. There just wasn't a lot to choose from in the early days of rock and roll. So she is the one. And yes, she did knock open a few doors, and we shall see other women rockers push through it as we move along in our story into the 70s and 80s and beyond. It's complicated. At least it's complicated for me. I guess that's why there are so many versions of her in the public mind, and a desire to be handed more. All right, that's enough from me. As always, tell me what you think. Contact us at Pantheon Podcasts on Facebook, at Pantheon Pods for Twitter, and R&R Archaeology on Instagram. Of course, there is the website at Pantheon Podcasts, or just call us at 650-822-7625. Who knows, you might even get me to call you back. All right, next week, famed rock and roll photographer Bob Gruen is in the house. He has a new book out, strictly called Green Day Photographs by Bob Gruen. Guess what band it's on? Yeah, as he tells me, it's the only band left that gives Bob full access at their shows so he can capture the magic that spontaneously happens, you know, like in the old days. As many of you might know, today's acts have management that treat photographers as a necessary nuisance, allowed in for only like 3 songs and then shoot out like infected rats. Yeah. We'll get into that and all kinds of things. So please come back to hear all about Bob Gruen. Until then, especially the ladies this time, keep up the rockin'.
Deeper Digs in Rock, produced and hosted by Kristen Swain. All sound design and incidental music by Busy Signal Studios.
Find all of our shows, notes, social, and links at www.pantheonpodcast.com or wherever you listen to great podcasts. All songs can be found for purchase on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Please purchase these great and important tracks. Find us on Facebook at The RNRAP. We are on Instagram at RNR Archaeology. Tweet us at RNR Archaeology.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.